To me, a structurally resilient community is one in which people grounded in their own interest are connected to each other with their hands on the levers of change. And so no matter what kind of challenges come to that community, mm-hmm. people are equipped with the relationships, with the capabilities, and with the motivations to be able to act on and strategize about how they want their community to respond to these changes that come their way. So then the question is, well, how do you develop a community mm-hmm. like that? And that's where I think civic engagement is really foundational in a lot of ways. The audacious promise at the heart of civil society is that there's something transformative about people coming together and having their self-interest transformed into common mm-hmm. interest, mm-hmm. learning how to take their own personal resources and put them towards the common good.
Welcome to the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing podcast, Aging Fast and Slow. This podcast is supported by the National Institute on Aging Pioneer Award. Thanks for listening. We are Dr. Sarah Zanton
and Dr. Deidre Cruz, your hosts. For the past several seasons, we have been exploring the dynamics of structural racism. In this season, we shift our focus to the extraordinary power of structural resilience. We will talk with scientists, thought leaders, and innovators about the importance of resilience that extends beyond the individual level to include communities and policies.
And today we have one of my favorite political scientists.
Joining us for this discussion is Dr. Hari Han, the director of the SNF Agora Institute, the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Professor of Political Science, and faculty director of the P3 Research Lab at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Han has examined ways that grassroots organizations translate the engagement of their people into political power. In this episode, we explore the intersection of societal structures, grassroots movements, and the resilient spirit of communities working to forge a more equitable future.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's delightful to have you.
Yeah.
So first, will you tell us what P3 means?
Sure. P3, we talk about how we're trying to make the participation of ordinary people possible, probable, and powerful. Mm. So people have to be able to participate, they have to want to participate, and then it has to actually matter. And so a lot of the research that we do is trying to understand how do you pull people off the sidelines into mm-hmm. public life, and then what is the scaffolding that you need to build around them in order to translate their participation into the kind of impact and power that they want in society.
So exciting.
Yeah.
So what is the impact of the hollowing of civil society, as you put it, on the implementation of scientific solutions to public challenges?
So I think one of the things that we've seen a lot in so many of the kind of most pressing public problems that we have in the world today, from the COVID pandemic to polarization to, you name it, disinformation, the changing technology, mm-hmm. is that even if you have really great solutions that government policymakers design, unless people are willing to engage with mm-hmm. them in the ways that we hope, mm-hmm. they don't actually have the impact that we want. So to me, COVID is a great example in the sense that there was this amazing ability of the scientific community
right.
to be able to come up with this vaccine
right.
in record time. But then when people wouldn't take the vaccine, our ability to actually solve the problem was
right.
really limited by that kind of resistance in the public. And so part of the work that we do is trying to understand what role do community organizations, civil society entities, you know, groups where people learn what it is to live in community with other people, mm-hmm. what role do they play in creating the kind of willingness that we need for people to adopt something like a vaccine or other kind
right.
of solutions that would be for the public good?
Yeah. Right. And when we used to have kind of shared media, that there were three networks and we all watched the same evening news, it was easier to have a shared sense of what was true.
Totally, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when we used to have a more unitary information environment, mm-hmm. it was a lot easier for people to have, like, we had a common perception, we had a
yeah.
common set
mm-hmm.
of facts, and then we were able to then kind of come to agreement on what those solutions are. Now we have a much more fractured information system, which makes it really hard. The one thing I always try to caution, though, when we think about that is that there are also good things about having
yes.
a more fractured
yes.
information
yes.
system, which is that there's a whole diversity of voices that were never
yes.
allowed in the past that are now on the table, and that's part of what's creating so much friction.
Mm.
And so part of what we think about a lot in both at the Agora Institute and in P3 is this idea that in the context when you have a fractured information system, you have to work even harder for people to be able to discover the kind of common
yeah.
bonds
mm-hmm.
and develop the habits and the capabilities that they need to be able to work with each other and live a common life together. And that is what civil society really should be doing. But because civil society has become so emaciated or hollowed out over time, we've lost that ability, and it's been exacerbated by things like the information system.
And for our listeners who haven't thought about the phrase civil society, can you just you know, give a kind of layperson's definition?
Yeah,
of what
so
that
people,
means.
So civil society typically is thought to be, if we sort of think of society as having a three-legged stool. So one stool is government, one stool is like business and markets, it's the economy, and then civil society is everything in between. Mm-hmm. So it's everything from churches, recreational organizations, social movements, grassroots entities, you know, the Rotary Clubs, the public parks and the libraries. You know, it's different people might have different definitions of how broadly they define it, but it's kind of that space that exists between the things that government does and the things that business and markets do.
Right. And I think that's how we're thinking about structural resilience is about civil society in a way.
Right. Yeah.
So building upon all the definitions that you nicely shared for us just now, how would you define civic opportunity, particularly in the context of the type of work that you do, and why is it crucial for moving this work forward?
Yeah, so maybe I can tell like a little historical story.
Sure.
So, you know, some people may have heard of Alexis de Tocqueville, who is like a French philosopher who came to the United States in the early 1800s. And he was trying to come and figure out like, what is this thing? Like, this is a democratic experiment that's going on in America, right? And at the time, it was like this very unusual phenomenon. So he comes and he travels all around the United States, like he's on horse and buggy or whatever, you know, kind of thing. And he comes away and he writes this huge tome called Democracy in America. But one of the things that really came out of it is this idea that part of what makes democracy work in America is that Americans are always joining with each other. They're always getting together and they're doing things. They're gardening together. They're hanging out at the pub together. Mm. They're going to church together. They worship together. They do all these things together. And even if that's not explicitly political, like they're not getting together to talk about like what should be our taxes or something like that, they're getting together and they're learning how to get to know each other, how to work with each other, what it means to work with people who are different from me, to hang out with people who are different from me. And those habits are foundational to making democracy work, is what he was saying. And so civic opportunity, in my mind, is the idea that it's the opportunities that people have to encounter those kind of experiences. And I think one of the things that we know is that people used to have many more of those kinds of opportunities. People had more of a place-based kind of community when people were more ensconced in their local lives and they weren't as distracted by the many myriad opportunities that could come from digital life, from globalization, from all these other things. Not that those things are bad, right? But just that it's changed the nature of our community life. And so what we want to do is look at, you know, what is the extent to which the opportunities that you give people and invite them into spaces where they can learn the kind of habits and proclivities that Tocqueville was talking about 200 years ago affect people's willingness to then figure out how can we live a common life together, you know, which I think is ultimately what democracy or politics should be about.
Wow.
So your research differentiates the demand side from the supply side when you're talking about social capital.
Right.
And can you tell us about this and why it's important?
Yeah. So the way that we think about the demand side and the supply side is the demand side is really about, you know, what is the extent to which people have the kind of sense of social trust, of connectedness, of all the things that we know that make communities work. And, you know, since the publication of books like Bowling Alone by Bob Putnam 20-some years ago, there's been lots of conversation about, like, why are Americans not bowling together? Like, why don't we trust each other? Why do people hate their neighbors? You know, things like that. And part of what I object to in that conversation sometimes is that, well, it is true that social trust has declined. It is true that people feel less connected to their communities. But on the other hand, how many times have people been invited into opportunities to meet their neighbors? How many times have people been invited into opportunities to learn how to work with someone who's different from them? And I think more and more people aren't invited into those opportunities, which to me is the supply side, really, you know? And so that for those of us who are trying to work on this question of how we build more resilient communities, we have to think not only about woe is me, what is the problem with the way people are reacting to all these societal changes, but what are the things that we can do to actually shape the chances that people have to take advantage of and learn from the opportunities to engage with people around them. And so that, to me, is a supply-side problem in a way. And I just sort of think that, like, thinking about how we can strengthen both the way in which we design the kind of opportunities that people have and then how equitably they're distributed across communities is just really important to thinking about some of these questions.
Great.
Wow. Yeah. I feel like inviting someone to go bowling. Sorry. I just had to. So what role does data science play in mapping these different civic opportunities that arguably we need really across our whole country? And And what insights does it provide about just even how these sorts of opportunities are distributed?
Right. So we decided to do this project where we're trying to use data science to map, you know, the landscape of civic mm-hmm. opportunity in America. And the reason why we want to do that is because I felt like I was in so many conversations where it almost felt like everyone was kind of like the drunk man looking for their keys under the light. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. is that we focus on what we can see, which is not necessarily the things that are the most important. And then, of course, you don't see what's left out.
Yeah, right.
And so it felt like one of the huge advantages of having the tools of data science is that for the first time, we could map civic infrastructure at scale in a way that we never could before. Because civil society, by definition, it's decentralized, it's fractured, it's very grounded in local communities, mm-hmm. as it should be.
Right.
But what that meant was when someone was like, oh, wow, you know, we just had a big fire in California. Like, what can we do in the Central Valley to try to help restore this community? And mm-hmm. someone else says, oh, well, you know, my barber's uncle told me there's this group that does this thing, you know.
Right.
And it felt like that's really the best that we can do. And actually, we can do much better because now all of these organizations kind of leave digital traces that enable us to map infrastructure at scale. Mm-hmm. And then what that revealed, in fact, is that there are these really patterned inequalities across America that – wealthier, wider, and better educated communities tend to have more civic opportunity than others, that it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's mm-hmm. offered in these kind of patterned ways. And also that the kind of organizations that are coming online in the past, like, 20 years are mm-hmm. really different from the kinds of organizations mm-hmm. that we used to see maybe 50 or 75 years ago.
How?
In what way?
So it's still true that the top providers of civic opportunity in America are faith institutions mm-hmm. and then, like, mm-hmm. social fraternal groups, which could be anything mm-hmm. from, like, sororities and fraternities to, like, Elks and Masons, but also, mm-hmm. like, ethnic clubs, like the Portuguese community of Baltimore or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the top providers of civic opportunity in America still. And then the third most likely provider are hobby organizations, so like mm-hmm. fly fishermen of western uh-huh. Wisconsin, you know, uh-huh. sort of bridge players of uh-huh. Timonium, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like those are all. But what we see is that those kinds of organizations tend to be declining mm-hmm. and that more and more the kinds of organizations that were coming up are issue-specific organizations, right?
Oh.
So it's like, you know, youth education or uh-huh. environmental activism or, you know, sort of different
right.
kind of issue-specific organizations. And the challenge there is that civil society organizations that are built around things like playing bridge or an ethnic club or something like that, they tend to bring lots of different kinds of people in so that
yeah.
you begin to sort of engage mm-hmm. with lots of different kinds of people who all share an interest in bridge but may have really different politics or may have really
right.
different backgrounds or different
mm-hmm.
things like that. But the environmental organizations tend to recruit people who are already environmentalists or something like
yeah.
that. So you see more homogeneity in that. And one of the things that I've learned a lot from doing work with a lot of groups in our research is this idea that, like, belonging comes before belief
mm-hmm.
and that first people feel a community of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do that, then their beliefs often follow from that. But the mistake that a lot of these, like, single issue organizations make is they think
right.
that belief comes before belonging.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we build organizations based on the idea that belief comes before belonging, you're creating a kind of fragility in the system
right.
that I think we're beginning to see the effects of in our politics now.
I think we have the title for the podcast.
Wow.
And I should just note that the notion belonging comes before belief is not my phrase.
Okay.
It comes from a church that I've done a lot of uh-huh. research with, which I'm happy
yep.
to talk about.
Yep.
But that's a catchphrase that this
uh-huh.
church uses,
uh-huh.
which is the idea that, you know, we might be a Christian church, but you don't have to believe in God. You don't have to believe in our God. You don't have to believe in any God. You're still part of our community. You're part of our community
uh-huh.
of belonging. Now we're going to try to get you to
right.
believe in
right.
our God, but they welcome
right.
people no matter what they believe.
Right.
And so that notion, I think, is a really
right.
profound notion
right.
that captures what is true, I think, in the research, but is not commonly understood sometimes in,
right.
in our politics.
Right. And so you mentioned that there's an unequal distribution of civic opportunity.
Uh-huh.
Can you say a little bit more about that and why that matters?
Yeah, well, so the nice thing about building this map using the tool of data science is that we can look at it at the level of census block,
mm-hmm.
you know, to county, to state, to national, whatever. And pretty much at whatever level you look at, what we see is that communities that have more privilege also have more civic opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which means that a lot of these, like, civil society organizations are located in areas where people who have more privilege are likely to be able to access them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true if we were to compare county to county. So richer counties have more civic opportunity than poorer counties. But then even when you look within one county or within one city, and so that, I think, really matters because then it's a question of, who are the kinds of people that are being invited into these opportunities, right? And who are the kind of people that are systematically being left out? And if, you know, if politics is really this question about how do we build a life together, who are we inviting into that conversation and who are we not inviting into that conversation? The other one, other pattern that we saw also is an urban-rural divide, that urban areas tend to have more per capita civic opportunity than rural areas. So they have more people, of course, you know. But even when you look per capita, it's more densely concentrated in urban areas than rural areas. My hypothesis is that some of this is driven by the way funding works, you know, because a lot of these organizations are dependent on philanthropic dollars or donations or things like that. And it's easier to access those kind of funding sources in certain kinds of places than others. So I think there's a way in which that might drive some of these patterns. But we're still looking at that data, so I'm not totally sure yet.
Yeah, and our colleague Bob Atkins has done some work about the blind spot that foundations have for rural areas.
Oh, yeah. I would completely believe that. Yeah, because we've just done a little bit of work, and even just looking at states like some of the southern states, you can see that so much of the money that comes from outside of states like Alabama or Mississippi get driven into the urban areas when a lot of the need often is in some of the more rural communities.
Yeah,
so it's a real challenge.
Yeah.
It's a real challenge.
Yeah, and I'm reminded also of one of our other guests on this podcast, Gilbert G., who talks about disparities in time. And it made me wonder how much of this is a function of these more privileged communities just having more time to sort of engage or think about a group that they might want to put together and what
they're
role
not
that
working
might be.
Job
right.
Or,
The data absolutely shows that people who have more free time or leisure time are absolutely more able to volunteer and give to their communities and so on. But in a lot of the work that we've done with different grassroots organizations and organizations that are explicitly trying to organize in low-income communities of color or other communities that might not have as much time, is that, you know, time is really an expression of value. And people put their time into things that are valuable to them. And so when I'm talking to organizations that are trying to engage communities and communities of color or communities that might otherwise not instinctively have more time, is that the challenge is not just to, like, make more time for them, but it's to sort of demonstrate your value, you know? And that's what I think a lot of organizations struggle with sometimes, because to really be valuable, you have to be really accountable to a group of people and figure out what their needs are and then how what you can do to sort of support those needs, which is just not how our nonprofit sector is set up at all.
So how do congregations, especially white evangelical communities, play a role in addressing racial injustice in America, given, of course, their size, their scope, and also their historical impact on political activism?
Yeah. Okay. So faith institutions, as I said, are a really important provider of civic opportunity in America, and that's still absolutely true. But you've probably also heard that a lot of churches are experiencing declines in their membership and in their congregation size. And we see more and more people becoming what we call religious nuns, right? Like there are people who don't affiliate with any religion, you know? And so that's on the rise in the past two decades or something like that. So that is also true. I actually have entered into a project where I've been doing a lot of work with, like, white evangelical megachurches. And part of the reason why I got interested in them is because they're kind of the growth edge of Christian churches in a lot of ways. And so a megachurch is defined as a church that has 2,000 or more members, about. And the average megachurch grew by 34% over the past decade. And the largest 9% of churches in America contain 50% of the church-going population in America.
Wow.
So what that means is that church attendance is heavily skewed towards large churches. Now, we could have a whole conversation about whether or not it's a good or bad, and I think there's a lot of, like, so I'm not stating that as an unequivocal good, but I'm saying that they're part of the growth edge of faith communities in America. And I have a book coming out next September that traces a group of people who've been organizing around racial justice within the third largest megachurch in America. And so the book is called Undivided, The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. And basically what happened in that church is that there was a black pastor who in 2015, so it's a white dominant church, meaning it's 80% white, 20% non-white, which is mostly black because it's located in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he stood up in 2015 and said, I feel called to speak on racial justice, essentially. And he started this program called Undivided that was trying to animate people into working on racial justice. And the book kind of traces the journeys of four people, two black and two white, who kind of like went through that program. And the hard work of not just thinking about their own orientations towards race and racial justice, but also the backlash and the pushback they received from their family, from their workplace, from other people in their church community, from engaging around this work. And so it kind of looks at, like, people nested within a community, nested within a bigger community, and how does that work happen at each of these levels?
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason why I was interested in that project is because, to your question, that white evangelical communities have always been a very large part of American society, just numerically speaking. You know, we were founded as like a white Protestant nation, and they've been culturally very powerful in a lot of ways, and then in recent decades also politically very powerful. And yet, you know, here's this group of people who are deeply committed to the faith tradition, didn't agree necessarily with the politics of where the church was going, and were trying to fight to make their church be the community they wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, to me, highlights a mismatch between the kind of strength and power of, like, individuals who are trying to do a lot of this work and the flawed institutions that we all inhabit, and how you navigate some of the complexities of that, you know, when you're really committed to an organization or something like that.
And I've read a draft, and it's excellent. I would suggest people read it when it comes out. I think one of the things that's so interesting about what you're talking about and what's in the book is I think the average listener to our podcast, if you say a predominantly white church and a mega church, would think, oh, that's not going to be an avenue for racial justice or racial understanding.
Yes. Can I just say one thing about that? So I think, like, you know, a lot of people probably read in the New York Times, like, you know, 8 in 10 white evangelicals voted for Trump and all those things. And that is true. The challenge with a lot of that data is that a lot of that kind of data that comes out is based on people self-reporting whether or not they're evangelical. So a pollster calls you up and says, are you Christian? Right. Are you, you know, are you evangelical? And people can choose to say yes or no. And what we know is that during the Trump era, the percentage of people who self-identify as evangelical and who attend services went way down. It dropped by like 30 or 40%, you know? And so what that meant was that the term evangelical became more of a political identity and less of a faith identity.
Right.
There might be people who believe in the faith tenets of evangelicalism, but don't like the political direction of the church, especially when it was associated with Trump. And so they won't say yes to that on a survey. And the people who say yes are the people who may or may not go to services. So part of what I hope with the book is that it exposes some of the heterogeneity that really exists in a lot of these faith communities. And the faith communities, I think, are still really powerful places where people draw a lot of meaning and a real sense of community and a real sense of belonging in ways that are really important. And they're growing, you know, so they're also just like a really important entity for us to understand. And I hope that people come to understand that, like, they aren't necessarily just the headline that you see.
Right. And I didn't understand until I read your book how much they are a whole community. You know, there's food pantry there, and your kids can maybe go to school there, and it's multiple evenings of the week. And, you know, if you start to go, it can be your whole community, not just on a Sunday morning.
Yeah. So the church that I did the most work with, you know, one of their phrases is belonging comes before belief. Another is we do life together. You know, so the idea is it's not just that you come and you listen for an hour on Sunday, but it's like we do life together. And so whenever they do have church events on like a Wednesday night, they always have childcare available so that parents can always come and then bring their kids. And people's lives are just really integrated in ways that, you know, I myself am not evangelical Protestant, but like I felt like, oh, like I want to be a part of that too. It's really, it really draws you in in ways I think that are really powerful.
So Hari, what are some of the key findings that you've had in terms of understanding the relationship between program participation and the feelings of those that have participated about, you know, how their personal efficacy or the efficacy of their community has changed and or their perceptions of the community? And how have you seen in your work that this level of engagement has resulted in meaningful action?
So maybe I'll scope out from thinking not just about the church, but also just sort of other organizations that we've worked with in P3. And I think there's a couple lessons that I've learned. So first is organizations that start with the question of who are my people are really different from organizations that start with the question of what is my issue. And most of students like come into Johns Hopkins and they're like, I'm really passionate about the environment or something like that. And then they have an issue and then they want to go out and find people who are going to like join them, which is really different than sort of saying, here's a group of people to whom I'm accountable. And then I'm going to figure out what our needs are. And then we're going to work on that together, you know? And so I think that what a lot of our work sort of shows is that organizations that are really grounded and accountable to a community of people, all this stuff kind of flows from that. Like, they become more strategic, they become mm-hmm. better able to address urgent problems in the community. There's all these kind of downstream effects in terms of the efficacy of the organization that emerges mm-hmm. because they're grounded in real people who have real problems to solve. So that's kind of like one lesson that I would think about. The second is that I'm a strong believer in this idea of, if you invest in people's agency, in the ability of people to feel like they can be architects of their own future, mm-hmm. then good things flow from that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's generally true, is that there are a lot of ways in grassroots organizations, I think, that instinctively want to try to get people involved where it's like the people are almost pawns in a game yeah. that someone else is designing mm-hmm. and controlling. What we find from a lot of the data is that can get short bursts of activity mm-hmm. that wane really fast. Mm-hmm. And to really make change, you can't just have a short burst. Like, change is a hard uphill right. battle in most right. cases. Mm-hmm. And so you need people sustained over the long term. You need people who are going to really commit. And in order to really commit, people have to feel like they can really be architects of mm-hmm. a future that they're going to be a part of really designing. And so that's sort of the yeah. second thing. And then the third thing I'll just say, which is related, is that just going back to the church, one of the things that I found that was so interesting about megachurches is that the church that I study the most, it's now a 35,000-person church. So they get 35,000 people that show up in person every weekend and about 500,000 people that tune in online. So it's a huge scale. And it's like, how could someone possibly belong to a church like that and then feel connected to another person? Mm-hmm. And they're organized around what they simply call small groups.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And these are self-organized, self-governing small groups. Mm-hmm. It could be anything from like a Bible study to people who want to like live on the West Side and want to have drinks on a Friday, or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is. It can be organized in lots of different ways, or new parents or mm-hmm. people that need financial support or something like that. And then they organize themselves into these groups where they something brings them together, and then they kind of figure out how to do life together mm-hmm. in a way yeah. in that group. And that, you know, as political scientists, we would call that like a federated structure. You know, you have like a small unit nested within a bigger unit. Mm-hmm. There's something really powerful about that, I think, because you feel really intimately connected to the people that you're in your small group with, but then you also feel like you're part of something bigger because
right.
you're. It's not yeah. just like a small group and that's it. It's a small group that's right. part of this much bigger community.
Right.
Yeah. So. Right. And I've been learning more about the science of awe, A-W-E,
uh-huh.
and there's a lot in that about the feeling like you're part of something bigger. That's
right.
almost like one of the definitions of awe. Uh-huh. And it sounds like a great combination to be in this smaller,
right.
you know, specific thing, but then the feeling of doing something altogether that's bigger and more
right.
meaningful.
And I think it also it feels like you're channeling power in a
yeah.
way, you know, which
yeah.
is that, like, I'm not just shaping this one little thing, but I'm also mm-hmm. part of something bigger, and we have the ability mm-hmm. to potentially shape something bigger. And mm-hmm. so that, I think, contributes to people's ongoing sense of their own efficacy and their willingness mm-hmm. to stay involved and so on.
Awesome.
So we see how clearly your work relates to structural resilience, but just in terms of spelling it out, can you talk to us about what you think the relationship and parallels between civic engagement and structural resilience are in your mind?
Yeah. You know, so to me, a structurally resilient community is one in which people grounded in their own interest are connected to each other with their hands on the levers of change, right? And so no matter what kind of challenges come to that community, mm-hmm. people are equipped with the relationships, with the capabilities, and with the motivations to be able to act on and strategize about how they want their community to respond to these changes that come their way. And that's what I think allows communities to bend without breaking,
right.
which in my mind is really mm-hmm. like a lot of what resilience
right.
is about. So then the question is, well, how do you develop a community mm-hmm. like that? And that's where I think civic engagement is really foundational in a lot of ways. You know, partly going back to the story that we talked about in the beginning of Tocqueville coming and sort of saying, mm-hmm. what's up with these Americans?
Right.
They all like join together. Like, that's the thing that they do. But it's because the audacious promise at the heart of civil society is that there's something transformative about people coming together and having their self-interest transformed into common mm-hmm. interest, you know, and mm-hmm. learning how to take their own personal resources and put them towards the common good. And that, I think, is what is at the heart of really building the kind of structures of resilience that we need. I think sometimes we think about structures and we think of like buildings, and
right?
Like, you know,
yeah.
like Congress
or
and
official structures,
or
that
officials,
are, right?
But those have to be built on this foundation mm-hmm. of people that mm-hmm. have that kind of resilient capabilities at the heart. And I think that's where I try to spend a lot of my time.
Yeah, thank you.
Awesome. So, what guidance would you offer to the next generation of scholars that would like to pursue this line of work that you've
yeah,
been working in?
So I have two ways of answering the question. One is more practical and then one is kind of a little bit broader. The practical thing is that one of the things I really learned over the course of 20 years of doing this work is that when I do the work in partnership with communities, it's mm-hmm. always better than when I don't, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's because even though we often sort of talk about this divide between practice and research, that really the questions that are keeping my friends who are organizers up at night, their strategic questions are the same as the conceptual questions that we're struggling with in academia. Okay, we use different language for them, for sure, mm-hmm. and we have different ways of asking the question, but they're really at the heart, they're asking the same question. So I think the work is better if it's always done in partnership. Mm-hmm. So that's like the practical piece. The second thing that I would say is Robin Kelly is a Black scholar who sort of talks about the idea that the work that he has to do as a scholar is three things. It's love, study, and struggle. And, like, I have that written on a post-it mm-hmm. on my desk, and mm-hmm. it's like, that's what I should be doing every day. Love, study, struggle. That's what I hope that my students can take with them as they build their careers.
Awesome.
Beautiful. A little more broadly, can you share one of the most valuable pieces of life advice you've ever received?
Yeah. So when I went to college, my older brother went to the same college that I did, and I, you know, was nervous about starting college, and I was leaving home. I'm the youngest in my family. Mm-hmm. And I remember he wrote me a letter. We still wrote letters
right,
back in the day.
Right.
And he wrote me a letter, and he said that, you know, one thing about going from, like, a small high school to a college that yeah. you go from, like, a little pond to a bigger mm-hmm. pond, and it can seem really intimidating because there's always amazing people around you, and they come from all over the country in a way that, like, our high school is just like our little community here. And he said, the best advice I can give you is that instead of seeing the people around you as threats or as competition, you should see everyone as an opportunity mm-hmm. because everyone, you can learn something from everyone around mm-hmm. you yeah. and just go around seeing everyone as an opportunity. And I've always carried that with me in my personal life, my professional mm-hmm. life, and I always feel like it's a great way to connect with and always find the nuggets in people that are always really exciting.
Yeah. Well, we've been lucky to have the opportunity with you.
So. Yes.
Hari, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been such a pleasure. For our listeners, check out our website, nursing.jhu.edu/agingfastandslow, for the articles and resources referenced in the episode. Have comments, questions, or guest suggestions? Reach out to us at agingfastandslow@jhu.edu.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend, rate it, or write us a review. Special thanks to Jennifer McCord for editing and sound design, Rafe Reggie and Florentina Costaca for technical expertise, Brian Fitzek for production, and Tim Carl and Danielle Kress for web design. See you next time on Aging Fast and Slow.